Hello, my name is Kate McKenzie and welcome to my show. Really lovely that you've dropped by to listen. I'm so happy you're here. Today I am sharing with you an interview with my dad, Colin McKenzie, and my sisters Tara and Georgia. He decided to write his memoir in lockdown, which was a great move as he's a doer. He likes to do things, and his wife suggested he write his memoir as something to do in lockdown one, and he did. And he produced his book, Pressing My Luck. So we decided to chat to him about his book and about the 80s, the 90s, and how reflective the series The Crown is about the royal family, Thatcher, Diana, what was going on, and what his reflections were about that time, being someone who reported and was a journalist during that time. So we asked him about it and what his thoughts were, and here's what he said. Hope you enjoy it.
Very excited, and we wanted to ask you, this is a little interview from the three of us, about the relevance of what you know about that's now being displayed in perhaps the programme like The Crown. What are your thoughts on how Thatcher, the Queen, these people are displayed when you actually had audiences or interviewed these kind of people?
Well, I knew Mrs. Thatcher early on in her career, before she was Prime Minister, but I saw a lot of her when she was Prime Minister, and I'm afraid the way she's portrayed in The Crown is more to do with our post-prime ministerial era. And she's portrayed as an old lady with a crick in her neck, without all the energy she had. Furthermore, I don't think she would have ever tried to lecture the Queen on matters of parliamentary procedure or the Constitution or anything like that. She would have been very aware of the Queen's position and the Queen's experience, and she would never have challenged her views on anything. She would have listened. And I would think that the Thatcher family could be rather justifiably annoyed with the way she was portrayed. The one item and one programme I did have a lot of knowledge about was when Michael Fagan invaded the royal bedroom and sat on her bed, because I was trying to do a documentary with Fagan about that incident about 6 years ago. And I met him for several times, and I sat down with our cameraman and my producer when I was doing this documentary to discuss how we would proceed with it. And all I can tell you is he was not a very articulate man, but he would never have been able to express himself as he did to the Queen in the series The Crown. He simply didn't have the vocabulary or the confidence to act like that. He's a fairly, how shall I put it, gentleman without much fluency in his life, either in his private life, in his language, or anything else about his life. And he simply couldn't have said the things he was alleged to have said. Struck me that this was the writer Peter Morgan's political views rather than Fagan's political views. That slightly irritated me.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. Yeah. Do you think though that sometimes artistic license has to be taken, because otherwise that scene could have been deadly dull and have no tension and have no entertainment value?
I understand that point very well, George, but I do think in this instance that everything that came out of his mouth was very political rather than chatty, like asking for a cup of tea or asking for a glass of wine, which is in fact what I'm sure actually went on, because I debated it with him. The writer decided to put a particular point of view about homelessness and the poverty and being working class and not participating, that his type of person was unable to participate in either the political process or life generally. And I think that was probably too much for him.
It's not meant to be totally based on facts anyway, The Crown, is it? It's you know, fiction as much as anything. That's what they're...
Well, there's plenty of diction, and I wouldn't argue with the way, for example, Princess Diana was portrayed very accurately and very expeditiously, I would say. It's what's in their mouths. I think you have to say this is largely fictional, although based on a certain amount of fact. But I don't think they've alerted the public to the fact that this is not, this isn't a factual documentary history of the royal family. This is pure drama, and that point should have been made more obviously, I think.
And the other the other things we know about is that you've had an audience with the Queen Mother, and you've been around the Queen. And so, what's your? And I want to come back to you, Georgia, as well. And what's your experience of that?
Well, I wouldn't say I had an audience with the Queen Mother. I was invited to pre-lunch drinks with her, and she very kindly invited Linda and me to have a 10-minute discussion with her about life in general. She was 90 years old at the time. She had a very sharp brain. We came just straight after a Channel 4 executive, and this was at Ascot Racecourse prior to lunch with the trustees there. She had a Channel 4 executive who was desperately trying to get the Ascot contract for Channel 4 away from the BBC. And I've never seen the Queen Mother do a better impression of Geoffrey Boycott, who famously was the cricketer from Yorkshire, who blocked every ball. A little bit boring to look at. And the Queen Mother managed to block his every entreaty to change the license or to change the contract from BBC to Channel 4. So when we sat down to have a chat to her, incidentally, she asked Linda, my wife, to sit down because she's 5'9". She was giving the Queen Mother a crick in her neck, which we thought was rather sweet. So we sat down to talk to her, and I congratulated her on being like Geoffrey Boycott, and she laughed. And then we discussed horse racing, which is her great passion, of course, and the expense of keeping horses in training. And we had a lovely long discussion about that because it's obviously one of my hobbies as well. And so we had 10 minutes doing that. And again, in The Crown, I would say she's portrayed as a very sort of silent, dumpy lady, whereas she had plenty to say for herself. And she probably did have very old-fashioned ideas and ideals, but she wasn't portrayed in a very kind light in The Crown.
Was it down to the royal family who got to film Ascot then between Channel 4 and BBC? Was it down to the Queen?
No, the Queen does own Ascot Racecourse nominally. Right. But of course she has trustees who actually make these decisions and a board of directors. So she could have some influence, of course, but this in fact was the Queen Mother, not the Queen. So they were actually asking the wrong person at that particular time. But I suppose the Queen Mother could have had input into it, but she was dealing with the questions he was firing at her very effectively.
So we just want to also ask, because your mother also was very influential, had the first television show on ITV.
She did indeed, and my stepfather also had the second ever programme, which was an advertising magazine. There is a slight connection with the Queen Mother too. Queen Mother was a great fan of my mother's magazine-based soap called Compact in the early 60s. And I believe the Queen Mother was going away on holiday and was going to miss the programme for 2 or 3 weeks. And my mother fielded a phone call from Buckingham, or I think it was actually from Clarence House, asking if there was any possibility that the Queen Mother could come on and talk to my mother about what was going to happen and elements of the programme she would miss in the next 2 weeks. And I believe my mother did in fact field that conversation. I was away at university at the time, so I only heard of it third hand. But the Queen Mother was very, very keen to know what was happening with the Compact storylines.
Are you saying that she didn't actually tell her anything?
I'm not quite sure whether my mother filled the Queen Mother, and I'm sure she would have done, in fact, because she would have known that that wouldn't go any further. I mean, had you been telling a sort of Fleet Street gossip columnist, then it would have ruined it for everybody. Yes. But she was telling the Queen Mother, who I'm sure would have been suitably discreet.
And so who when you were with Led Zeppelin, going on the planes with them, what was your experience then?
Well, as I say in the book, I wasn't particularly familiar with Led Zeppelin's music. I was keener on classical music. And when the bureau chief in New York asked me to shoot down to Newark to catch their private jet with them and go on tour to the Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh, where they were planning an enormous concert, I said to my boss, I said, well, I don't know their music and I don't know who's in the band even. And he said, well, it'd be better because you'll be objective about the whole thing. Well, it was the most extraordinary experience of my life, because having got on their plane, I was photographed with Robert Plant just as we were about to get on their Starship 707, specially adapted for a pop group with jacuzzis and double bedrooms and goodness knows what. Wow. I had a long chat with Robert Plant, who was extremely charming, and then met the manager, Peter Grant, a great big chap who was quite tough. And when we got to Pittsburgh, we landed, and there was a cavalcade of 12 stretch limos, and I was in number 6 limo. And it, honestly, it was like being the President of the United States. Huge crowds down all the roads, police outriders, and I'm in number 6 of 12 limos going to this concert in this enormous baseball stadium. I mean, it was quite surreal, and I've never experienced anything else like that in my life. So I had a sort of moment when I felt I was almost president of the world. And then we got to the concert, and before the band would go up on the stage, Peter Grant, in my presence, insisted on counting the cash take, which was over $120,000, before he would allow the band to go on the stage. And then I asked if I could be on the stage with them, which was granted because I was having free access on Marv the Daily Express. And I was stuck there for 3.5 hours. Now, I'm not saying it was that unpleasant, but I didn't particularly like the music. It was so loud, I could hardly think afterwards. The amplification was about 100 feet high on either side of the stage. The band went off for a sort of mid-concert break and left the drummer there, John Bonham, to do a 20-minute drum solo while they rested. And I was still stuck on the stage, unable to go and have a pee, unable to rest my ears or anything. And when the concert finally finished just after midnight, I've never felt more relieved in my life. It wasn't a pleasant experience, I have to say, because I wasn't a Led Zeppelin fan. I didn't know any of the music. Some of the music I've listened to since is terrific, but this was a novel experience for me at the time.
Was it a shocking experience at all? Because that was their most famous year. So they were, you know, probably sex and drugs and rock and roll and...
Oh, there was all that going on. It wasn't so much shocking as eye-opening. And of course, I mentioned in the book, there was a terrible follow-up story, because when the band ended the tour, they went working in New York at the time, and Peter Grant put all their cash takings, which was way over $500,000, into the hotel safe and got the night clerk to do this. And the night clerk suddenly thought, this is going to represent a change of my circumstances. And 24 hours later, the safe was opened again. The night clerk disappeared into over the horizon, and all Led Zeppelin's money went with it. Now, I imagine, I don't know for certain, because I left New York before the whole thing was resolved. I don't think the clerk was ever caught, to the best of my knowledge. And I imagine the hotel's insurance had to cough up whatever Led Zeppelin said was in the safe. But it was an extraordinary follow-up story.
We're here to talk about the scoop of the century, Biggs. Now, what we wanted to ask you about is, obviously, as Brough said, this was an amazingly chaotic scoop with a huge amount of difficulty and trauma, and it ended up being, you ended up being the most famous journalist and the most trodden upon journalist at the same time. So when you think about that story, that you got this scoop and you went to Brazil and you met Biggs, but people advised you, like Brian Vine, to stay with the Express, who then shoved you one. What do you feel? Do you feel, I wish I hadn't, I shouldn't have taken Brian's advice? You had an instinct, you wrote about this in the book, I had an instinct about the editor. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I had an instinct about the editor, who was a little out of his depth. He'd been the editor of the Scottish Daily Express, which didn't cover a lot of foreign stories. It tended to focus on football and murder, two of the most prominent news items in Scotland. And when he came down to London to take over from a very famous editor called Bob Edwards, he encountered a mistake fairly early on. I was running the night news desk one evening in September 73, when the paper claimed to have found Martin Bormann in Buenos Aires. And he was the Nazi who very largely masterminded a lot of the war under Hitler and was responsible for all sorts of horrendous goings on in the Second World War. And he had escaped and hadn't faced trial at Nuremberg or any of these other things, and was among a number of prominent Nazis in South America. So it was a huge story. And we'd photographed this man crossing a street in Buenos Aires and said it was Bormann, who was a director of various South American companies. Well, I walked straight into the editor's office that night. It had been a very secret thing. We'd had a reporter and photographer in Buenos Aires for 6 months chasing the story. And there was a lot of secrecy. And the first I knew of it was when the first edition came out that night. I walked in to see Ian McColl, who was the editor. And I said, with my knowledge of South America, my fluent Spanish, I should be sent out straight away to be backup to the team out there. And he said, oh, Colin, that's not as simple as that. He said, this is a very slippery individual. We don't know exactly where he lives. I said, hang on a minute. We've got a photograph of him. We must have followed him from somewhere. We must know roughly where he is. Oh, no, Colin, he's a very slippery individual, he said. So that was my first concern. And then, of course, within a week, we had a libel, a writ for libel from a perfectly innocent Argentine school teacher who was the man we had photographed crossing the street in Buenos Aires. Some of the companies we'd alleged he was a director of knew nothing about it and had never either met Bormann or knew of Bormann. And it turned out to be a complete fiasco and a farrago of the truth, as it turned out. And this happened 3 months before I then arrive in the editor's office and tell him, I think I've found Ronnie Biggs in Brazil. And all the editor can think of is more problems, more pound signs going over the horizon, another Walter Mitty living in Brazil claiming to be Biggs, such and such and such. So he never received the story with the greatest of enthusiasm that most other editors of Fleet Street would have done. Yeah. And that's when I started getting nervous.
Yeah, but can I say, when you were able to prove it was Ronnie Biggs, why do you think he took that information to the police? I know you explain in the book that he was sitting next to the assistant deputy commissioner of the Metropolitan Police at a dinner, but do you think that it was more than just, you know...
He was engaging an insurance policy because he felt that if the police, Scotland Yard, were out in Brazil arresting Biggs, there could be no doubts in anybody's mind we got our man. And of course this was ludicrous because I had already presented him with a letter from Biggs with his fingerprints all over it. It was easily checkable. And there was no extradition arrangement between Brazil and Britain in those days. I would have advised Biggs, and he agreed to do this, to give himself up to the British consulate in Rio de Janeiro. And we would have come back with the story in the bag on a plane. He would have been arrested at Heathrow Airport and sent to jail to complete his sentence. Now, Mr. McColl, because of his history with South America, was a very, very nervous and unsure man. And that's why he told Scotland Yard to get the insurance.
But the thing is, how is it that, what if he'd given duff information to Scotland Yard? Then he'd have looked like an even bigger fool. And another thing also is, aren't journalists much like priests? You don't have to reveal your sources and you don't have a moral duty to turn people in the same way.
Well, that's absolutely true. There was no doubt it was Biggs because they had the fingerprints, and unknown to me, he sent the fingerprints to Scotland Yard to prove it was Biggs. So they were under no illusions that it was Biggs once he'd sent that letter to me. Furthermore, I had not only interviewed him from home to check who he was, but I then re-interviewed him with the news editor of The Express, Brian Hitchin, listening in. and answering all the questions they had given me, most of which I'd already asked him. But he was very patient and willing, and he answered all those questions. So there never was the shadow of doubt that it was Ronnie Biggs. So I agree with you. He broke most of the so-called Fleet Street ethics by bringing the police in. And it was his own personal insecurity that caused this.
Tara, do you have a question about the Biggs story?
Not about Biggs, though.
You've got some more questions about racing. So about the Biggs story, I know you did a lot to try and help Biggs stay in Brazil, and you got him a lawyer, and then you did his story, and you gave his book to him, and you interviewed Charmian. What happened between you and Biggs in the end? Because it seems like he didn't understand that you were not the one who wanted to dob him in. You didn't want, so, you know.
What happened, my love, is that another book written by a Fleet Street colleague from the Mirror called Slip Up came out. Uh-huh. And this revealed what I've now revealed, and of course, in my book now, that of course I had pre-knowledge of the arrest. Of course, as it turned out, I was going to tip Biggs off, and so was the photographer, Bill Lovelace, and give him the opportunity to shoot off into the interior of Brazil if he wished to do so, mm-hmm. or to give himself up. But the paper brought the arrest forward by 48 hours because they claimed that the Sun had made an inquiry to Scotland Yard asking about Biggs's whereabouts. Mm-hmm. So they were panicking in the office back in Fleet Street, mm-hmm. that some other paper might get hold of the story. Now, I don't personally buy that story at all. I think they simply wanted it in the bag. Scotland Yard were furious that they were having to sit in a nearby hotel while Biggs was giving me an interview, and they were unable to arrest him. So mm-hmm. I'm sure that they lent on the editor to bring the whole thing forward. So there was no chance of me tipping off Biggs, because by the time I knew they brought the arrest forward, Biggs had gone off into the night with his girlfriend. There were no mobile telephones. I had no idea where he was. And the next morning, the police had quietly surrounded our hotel, the Trocadero. So when Biggs walked in with his girlfriend at 10 a.m., they had their man already. So although I had to wait 15 minutes interviewing Biggs on the bed in the room there, and him being photographed by Bill Lovelace with his girlfriend, in fact, that was the worst 15 minutes of my life, because I knew what was about to happen. I could have told him he was about to be arrested, but what difference would it have made?
Anyway,
he took it badly when this other book came out, which said correctly, as it turned out, that I had been given prior knowledge of this arrest, of his potential arrest.
And did you feel like you wanted to let him know how it worked out for you?
I would have let him know had I had the chance. I never had the chance to tip him off, but possibly I should have rung him before I even left England and said, look, this might happen, what do you want to do? But combination of the fact that I felt I had the time when I was going to be in Brazil originally it was going to be 2 weeks, then it was brought back to 4 days, and eventually he was arrested after 2 days. And of course, from a journalistic point of view, I hadn't even got the story out of him properly. We'd spent the whole day photographing him in various Rio locations to establish why he was there and the fact that he was there. And so he'd hardly said anything. He imagined we were going to have 2 weeks, nice restaurants, plenty of time to talk about his life on the run, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, this whole thing was brought forward to less than 48 hours by the office by the time we were able to get hold of him. That was one of the great difficulties. It was very third world communications. You could book a call to the office. You'd have to sit around your bedroom waiting for the call to come through. And it was usually between 4 and 5 hours. And that hampered us enormously under the pressure.
Was your writing always done by phone? Because these days it's so easy write your stories online.
There were no computers in those days.
Yeah, how did you manage to?
No computers that could file through. So you had to telephone your office and deliver it to copy takers.
Wow.
Now, because of security, two very experienced reporters took our copy down. Now, Brian Vine had arrived late on the Thursday night and was in charge of operations. So I gave him all my background notes to the background.
Did he have to type it up?
No, he just did it. I'd written it all out in longhand. I'd spent the whole of the night before.
Like a fax.
I wrote the whole story out in longhand. He filed all that while I filed the actual story of the arrest and how it happened and what Biggs had been doing in Brazil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we were on two separate phones filing different stories.
Further to what Kate started with earlier, do you regret staying with the Express for that story?
I do. In hindsight, of course I do. I mean, the only comparable case I can think of in recent history is when my friend Andrew Morton wrote the Diana book. And of course, he'd had total 100% cooperation from Diana. And yet in the papers, until her death, when he was able to reveal what had happened, he was regarded as a pariah in Fleet Street. And that was exactly how I was regarded by my rival papers, that the Express had dobbed Biggs into the police, and I was the chief culprit. And so it didn't turn out well for me at all.
That's what happened. Because in your book, you say that you went to the editor and you decided to leave, even though a new editor was coming in. But was it that you were perceived as a pariah, and that's what made you want to leave at that point?
Well, this was a year later when I'd been given a year sabbatical to write my original Biggs book.
Right.
By then, which was, I suppose, 10 months after the arrest, I had decided I wanted to move on anyway. So I said, look, if you make me bureau chief in New York, I'll stay. But otherwise, I wish to leave. And by then, Ian McColl had been replaced by Alistair Burnett, late of ITV. Oh. And he was the new editor. Oh. And he said, look, I can't give you that job. What do you want to do? And I said, I think we both know I want to leave. And that's how it was left.
Well, did you leave because of what McColl had done?
Sorry.
Did you leave because of what McColl had done or because they didn't give you the New York job?
No, largely I wanted to leave to try my hand at writing and freelancing. Hmm. I was pretty certain they wouldn't give me the New York job, even though I had been there, worked there for 3 or 4 months of the year before, because they would have had to get rid of the existing person, which they didn't want to do, quite understandably. But I wanted to make it difficult for them to keep me. And so we just agreed to part company, basically. But it did have the effect that I was blamed for the police presence in Brazil, which was nothing to do with me.
Got it. So you took you were shamed out of town.
Not exactly shamed out of town, but it left a rather nasty feeling in the taste buds. For example, that story would have won me Journalist of the Year in any other year, but for the fact that colleagues who might have voted for me or colleagues on other newspapers and other newspapers decided that the Daily Express had behaved in an underhand manner, and therefore I didn't get Journalist of the Year that year.
Wow. So did that leave you feeling like you didn't want to do journalism, or did it leave you feeling, what did it leave you with? Do you feel lack of trust in editors and journalism as a whole? Or?
No, I know how newspapers work. I felt very, very annoyed with Ian McColl, the editor of The Express. I don't think another editor would have acted that way. And what I did regret was that I'd been offered a job on the Mail prior to going out to Rio. I never let on to the Mail, of course, that I had this story, but had I done so, I know for a certain fact that the editor of the Mail, David English, would have acted in a completely different way. There was no illegality in going to Brazil to check up on the whereabouts of Ronnie Biggs. There was no there was no cooperation between the two countries in terms of law or exchange of prisoners or anything. So we wouldn't have been breaking the law to go to Brazil to check if it was Ronnie Biggs. And I know that English would have let me do all that, had at least a week or two with Biggs, prior to Biggs giving himself up, and the Daily Mail would have been king of the castle, not perceived to have let anybody down, but returned a villain to prison who was costing Scotland Yard an absolute fortune when they tried to find him around the world. I mean, it was hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds.
And when Slip Up came out, did you feel like you wanted to tell Biggs your side of the case?
Well, it was quite difficult because he was in Brazil and I was here. But I I think Slip Up only came out after I last saw Biggs in 75. He got wind of it, but I don't think it had actually come out. And so we were slightly distanced by the time I gave him a copy of my book on him. No, at that stage, I was trying to bluff it out. But of course, in the end, Slip Up revealed, it wasn't entirely accurate throughout, but it was a fairly accurate portrayal of what went on, although it did portray me as a naive abroad, which I was a bit irritated with, as you can imagine.
So in a way...
Moving on to happier times, later in your career, what must it have been like for you to become a horse racing journalist?
As you girls probably know to your cost, I was a little bit of a racing fan, even in your
youth. Just a bit.
I used to like to watch it on a Saturday afternoon. And I had little bits and pieces of horses I owned down the years.
Yeah.
And of course, when I got the phone call, I was on the Daily Mail by then in 1985, from Bruff Scott saying he was going to create a new newspaper called The Racing
Post. That must have been a bit scary.
It was a little bit scary because you never know if these institutions will survive. But he assured me that he had very solid financial backing from Sheikh Mohammed of Dubai. And I didn't really need a second invitation. And the thrill of starting up a new newspaper was quite something. It's almost like giving birth to one of you beautiful girls, but not, of course, nearly as important.
So what's that like when you're invited back in a way to give your own, when you've had that kind of rough experience of the year, you could have been Journalist of the Year, and then Bruff invites you back into the fold, but in an area you're very comfortable with. What's that like?
Well, it was very exciting and very very kind of Bruff to do it, and I hope I worked my socks off, which I did for 3 years with the Racing Post, to such an extent that David English, who'd been a little bit annoyed to see the byline on the big story, having offered me a job only 3 weeks before, was welcoming me back to the Mail. And I had a lovely interview with him, and he said, well, you're the natural person to take over from Jim Stanford, who was retiring. So that was very pleasing. And by then, I'd re-established myself in Fleet Street.
Yeah. So there was a healing for you around newspaper.
There was a healing, but I was in a comfortable part of the paper. It wasn't the most important part of the paper, but I had a lot of space, which sadly my successors don't get.
You were lucky enough to have another big scoop in the racing world, of course, with the drugs thing.
I had several fairly big stories doing racing. I mean, I was very lucky. My very first month or two on the paper, a lovely old horse called Desert Orchid, who was rather like Red Rum, went beyond the racing pages, won the Cheltenham Gold Cup. And on that day, which was in March 1989, none of my colleagues, for some reason, usually you have a big sports feature writer and possibly even a newsman at Cheltenham for these big occasions, but there was nobody else there. So I was writing not only the racing story, I was writing the background as a sports feature, I was feeding the feature pages of the Daily Mail, and I was feeding the news pages of the Daily Mail. I didn't leave the race course till about 11:30 at night that night.
You did everything.
I did everything. And it got me really established back on the paper.
Ah, congratulations.
That wasn't a scoop. It was just jolly hard work.
You were the prodigal son in a way. You had a return.
Well, yes, it wasn't to the Express, but it was the prodigal son went back to his own home. Yeah. And I was back in Fleet Street big time, yes.
Yes, 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 yes. And that must have felt satisfying.
It was very satisfying. And then 20 years as that in that role for the Mail, I delivered quite a lot of good scoops. In fact, right at the end of my career, at the tail end of 2007, there was a court case in the Old Bailey in which the champion jockey Kieran Fallon was one of several people accused of corruption. And eventually there wasn't enough evidence put together by the racing authorities to convince the jury. And the judge, in fact, called a halt to the case halfway through. And all my other colleagues had Kieran Fallon back riding on the Monday following. This was a Friday afternoon when the judge said there was no case to answer for the various defendants. And I had got wind of the fact that Kieran Fallon, the champion jockey, had failed a second dope test or drug test in France that summer for cocaine. And I knew that the penalty, when it finally emerged, would be an 18-month ban on his riding. So he wouldn't be able to go back to being the number one rider for the Irish Coolmore team, where he was making a huge success of his career, for at least two flat seasons. So I came out with this story on the back page of the Mail on the Saturday morning, and I remember John McCrurick on the Morning Line pulling up this story, utterly astonished that nobody else had got it, and slightly disbelievingly saying, Colin McKenzie says that Kieran Fallon's going to be out of the game for 2 years. Well, luckily for me, the story turned out to be completely accurate and correct, and poor Mr. Fallon lost his job with the Coolmore team, obviously, because he couldn't ride for them for 2 years. The story was quite a good sort of postscript to my career, as it were, on the Daily Mail.
So back being an investigative journalist?
In a way, every journalist does a bit of investigative reporting, whether it doesn't matter who you are, rugby, cricket, or anything, or any part of the paper, and even female writers writing on the female section of the paper. Everybody can be an investigative reporter if they come up with a good story.
What do you feel about if you were starting your career today? Do you think you'd have had, you talk a lot about luck in your book, and obviously the title is Pressing My Luck, but you know, in life, we all need a bit of luck on our side. But do you think today, because there's so much out there on social media, that we know a lot already about people? Whereas in your day, celebrities were really behind closed doors, and if you got wind of something, it really was a scoop. Do you feel like you were working during the golden age of paper newspapers?
I think you put your finger on the whole thing, George. You had to go and source a lot of the stories yourself. There was no Twitter, no social media, no Facebook. If you wanted a story, you had to go out and get it and confront the person concerned. I mean, there's one tiny little story right at the beginning of my career where I was asked on the William Hickey gossip column to get a few people to talk about the first day of term at Eton, only because they tended to be people socially interesting to William Hickey. And I thought, well, I'll just take a chance. I'll try and ring Harold Macmillan, who'd been prime minister only a few months earlier, had resigned partly over the Profumo scandal, and partly because he thought he had prostate cancer, which luckily in the end he didn't have. And so I rang Macmillan Publishers, where he was nominal chairman, and asked to be put through to the chairman's office and expected to hear a secretary on the line. Blow me, the great man answered the phone himself. I said, Mr. Macmillan, yes, the wonderfully patrician voice. I said, I wonder, I'm doing a little story about what the first day of a new boy at Eton is like, and I wonder if you could tell me what your experience was. And he thought about it long and hard, and he said, Mr. McKenzie, I'm very grateful for your question, but I have to tell you that as a publisher, my reminiscences are copyright, which I thought was a wonderful quote. And of course, it went in the paper, because it was so, you know, he wasn't disagreeable at all. He was thoroughly cooperative, but he didn't want to tell me because he was his own memoirs.
You know, you in your book, La Taylor appears a lot.
She does. I had two or three meetings with her. First time I met her, I was actually with your mother. We weren't engaged then, but we were going out. So it was 1966, and I was sent up to cover the premiere of a play that Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor were in, Dr. Faustus, at the New Theatre in Oxford. And there was a post-theatre party at the Radcliffe Hotel. They were actually staying in Woodstock at the Bay Hotel in Woodstock, but they came to the post theatre party, and I filed a piece about how they'd got on in the play. And your mother and I sat down at quite a small table with just one other couple from Wales sitting there. And as you know, your mother was born in Crickhowel and lived in Abergavenny in her childhood, so we had quite a bit in common with this Welsh couple. And I thought we'd just spend the rest of the night having a chat to them. And blow me, Richard Burton spies them. And these are his oldest friends in the world. He used to know them when he was born in Wales. And so he came and sat with us, and we had a lovely chat with him for one or two hours. And Elizabeth kept coming up and stamping her foot and saying, "Richard, we've got to talk to the angels." Well, the angels were the people who were backing the play, as you know, and the producer. And he said, "No, I'm much more interested in talking to my friends here, blah, 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 blah." And eventually she sort of stamped her foot and said, "Well, I want to go back to the hotel, I'm going to bed." And he used an expletive deletive and said, "Well, you go back to the hotel, my dear. F off." My astonishment. And so she did. And anyway, before the evening was up, I explained to him that I was on the Daily Express. It would be remiss of me not to ask for an interview. And very sweetly, he said, "Come to the Bear Hotel in Woodstock, 10 o'clock in the morning. Oh. I'll give you breakfast." And you know, he was as good as his word.
Oh.
His breakfast was a bottle of vodka. My breakfast was a piece of toast and coffee. But he gave me a very nice interview for about half an hour. It was wonderful. That's what making the most of your luck is all about. And I was blessed throughout my career to get bits and pieces of luck like that.
So,
and the second time I met Richard and Elizabeth was when 2 years later, he'd just been in a film. What was that film he did with Clint Eastwood? Not Guns of Navarone, the other one. Where Eagles Dare.
Oh, I love that film.
I think it was Where Eagles Dare. And they were coming to London to promote it. And Elizabeth had some pet dogs, and she was damned if they were going to do the 6-month quarantine that dogs had to do if they import them into this country from abroad. So you know what they did? They hired the largest yacht ever seen in the London Basin, parked it by Traitor's Gate, so that Richard could come and do his promotion of the film. And she stayed on board this enormous yacht with her dogs, so they didn't have to go into quarantine. So I interviewed him about that. It was lovely and quite an extraordinary story again, you know. And then the third time, sadly, their second marriage broke up, and I was sent to New York to interview her. And she was on the Long Island in a little place called Quogue. And she pretended on the phone from the office in New York, she pretended to be a Spanish maid. And I realized it wasn't, but she wasn't going to budge. And so I suddenly remembered that my lovely colleague, Bill Lovelace, the photographer who came to Brazil with me, had been best man at their second, he had been one of the witnesses at the second time that Burton and Taylor got married. And I rang the office in London and they said Bill was in Hawaii on some travel feature, but he would get back to me. And 5 minutes later, Bill rang me from Hawaii. He said, "Look, what do you want me to do?" I said, "Can you ring this number where she's staying in Quogue? Tell her not to pretend to be the registered Spanish maid, but to talk to me, because I know it's her, and I met her a couple of times before." Bill was as good as his word, and as soon as I rang back, she was wonderful. She said, "Yes, sorry about that, but I'm trying to steer clear of the press." Oh, she didn't steer clear of me.
Understandably.
So that was amazing. And how could you call her La Taylor?
Well, but you just a way of, instead of saying Elizabeth Taylor, you call her La Taylor. That's just a facility you use, you know.
Oh, okay.
Instead of Burton and Taylor, I said Richard Burton and La Taylor. I mean, it's just to alter things. You don't want to keep on saying Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor in the same story.
Okay. Tara, you wanted to, and Georgia, you wanted to ask some things?
I've asked my bits.
So, so what would you say, now we're encouraging you to get into Twitter and get relevant with the young. What would you say about you getting engaged and telling these stories, these relevant stories, and bringing this wisdom through, you know, and telling people about what it was like in the days of 3-hour lunches and being able to ring Macmillan? And how do you feel about
it? Yes, I haven't mentioned much about the 3-hour lunches, and they weren't all that common. But I do remember one little story I say in telling the book, you were too young to remember, was when, of course, Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. And I'd stayed up all night. It was the most thrilling television, live television, to actually see somebody walking on the moon. We had no idea whether it was marshmallow, hard rock, whether he'd be consumed or what was going to go on. But there was so much uncertainty and the sheer danger of landing the thing. And he nearly ran out of fuel in the the extra little thing that landed on the moon, it almost ran out of fuel, and he had to direct it by hand because the computers went wrong. So we didn't really know any of that, but just to see it was quite extraordinary. And I hadn't gone to bed, but I thought I was due in the office the next day. And by then I was the education correspondent. And I took a little chance and I thought to myself, the chances of me being in the paper tomorrow with an education story were about 1,000,000 to 1, because the whole paper was going to be devoted to this incredible feat of these Americans landing on the moon. And so I went into the office, and true, of course, there was plenty of champagne in the office. And then we all went over to Elvino's and celebrated this extraordinary achievement, knowing full well we'd never, well, most of us anyway, would never be asked to work on the story. So I had a day's work, as it were, celebrating this enormous achievement in the watering holes of Fleet Street. Now, that didn't happen that often, but it happened quite often.
Now, what you told me before was that because Fleet Street was near the Old Bailey, barristers and journalists all hung out, so there was a kind of sharing of stories.
Yes, it wasn't actually the Old Bailey. It was right opposite the High Court. The Old Bailey was only up Ludgate Hill, so it wasn't far away. But the lunchtime in the Wigan Pen or the Elvino's was about a 100-yard walk for barristers and people like that. So you could meet barristers in Elvino's as well as journalists. And the Wigan, the Pen, of course, is the name of the club, which applies to the barristers and journalists. And indeed, funnily enough, talking about the moon, but one of my first stories in the Express where I had a byline was the premiere of Far From the Madding Crowd, and Terence Stamp and Julie Christie were the stars. And Julie Christie had one of those, she had a lovely skirt on, and it blew up Marilyn Monroe style to reveal her legs as she walked into the premiere. And that particular day, the Express was experimenting with bouncing a picture off the moon.
Oh, wow.
And publishing it in Mexico the same day, instantaneously.
Wow.
And this was only in 1967. And that worked. And the Wig and the Pen had the front page of the Express that day sitting in its foyer for 30 years until the owners sold it on.
Wow.
Which was with my byline, which was rather special. But just to think that within 2 years of that picture being bounced off the moon, man would actually land on the moon, just showed how fast things were moving in those extraordinary times.
Very
good. When I was at drama school, when you had your measurements taken before the final year plays, and they were all put in this enormous tome that was about this thick, and you could go back over the years, and I remember seeing Julie Christie's measurements in the book, which my never told you that, but now it seems relevant.
Has she got her name on the steps like you have?
Yes.
Amazing. You give us a byline for you and your book, Your Life, this time. What would you say?
I've been a lucky bugger.
Now, I wanted to say one thing about luck. Peter York said that everyone gets opportunities, everyone. He said most people don't see them. Some people see them, but just let them pass them by. And some people are prepared, see them, and make them into something. And that's luck. What do you say?
Yes, I think that's very true. He's absolutely nailed it. And I suppose I'm not a particularly courageous person, but I did take life with both hands and try to make my life lucky.
Right.
And I think if you sit back and do nothing, that will never happen to you.
So you were prepared when those magical moments happened, like Elizabeth Taylor, like Biggs, like Fallon, like different things have happened in your life. You were already ready to take action when the action needed to happen in those moments.
Yeah, to some extent, it's taking a risk and having the guts to do so.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest, most reporters in Fleet Street was like-minded. I wouldn't say I was in any way special. I don't know how I attracted good stories, but I attracted more than most.
Yeah.
And then it's a matter of taking your opportunities once that happens.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you so much for this wonderful interview.
I think it's always really interesting to have the perspective of people who were around during certain times and ask them what their thoughts were. I know for me, I have found really interesting moments with my dad, because I've asked him about periods of history or people in history. Like, did people really know what Jimmy Savile was up to? Or did people really know what was going on with certain things? And what he's reminded me of, that there's always several realities at the same time. And these several realities at the same time is different people knowing different things. Or some people are so connected to such powerful people that they get protected at that time. But later on, it may be allowed to be revealed. And so when people get very strong beliefs about one thing, I'm always reminded that there'll be other beliefs from another direction, and they can all exist at the same time. So I just think, yeah, really interesting to have been able to interview my dad, and I think it's great to ask your family about stuff and ask their perspectives. Visit someone else's world, see how they think about things. So I hope you enjoyed today, and I hope you can tune in for another show. Thanks very much.